Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening. I'm Santa Clara County Supervisor Joe Simidian. My office and I are very pleased to co-host tonight's program once again with the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. I want to begin by saying again, as I have at each of the previous two sessions, how lucky I think we are to live in one of the most diverse places in the country, but also to note that without understanding the diverse cultures around us, misconceptions abound. Our goal this evening is therefore very simple. We want to create a better understanding of Islam among the general public, and our topic tonight specifically is women and Islam. Let me begin by introducing tonight's two panelists who have agreed to discuss this topic with us. Sambul Ali Karamali, to my immediate right, is the author of The Muslim Next Door, which, by the way, I have read and can recommend. She received her undergraduate degree from Stanford University, her law degree from UC Davis, and has a graduate degree in Islamic law from the University of London School of Oriental and African Studies. Sambul serves on the board of a nonprofit education institution that teaches multicultural education and is on the steering committee of Women in Islamic Spirituality and Equality. Please join me in welcoming her. Thank you. Maha El-Janedi is the executive director and founder of the Islamic Networks Group. She received her undergraduate degree in political science and economics from the American University in Cairo. She received her master's degree in religious studies from Stanford University. Maha has been recognized with numerous awards, including the Civil Rights Leadership Award from the California Association of Human Relations Organizations. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me one more time in welcoming both Maha El-Janedi and Sambul Ali Karamali. So tonight's topic is women and Islam. Let me go right to the heart of the matter by asking this question. Are men and women equal in the eyes of Islam and Allah?
And Allah?
And Allah.
Which means God.
Which means God.
In Arabic.
So who would like to begin?
I can.
Please do. Maha.
So Allah doesn't speak. At least I haven't heard him speak. Or Islam doesn't speak. So it would really depend on who you're asking the question of. There are 1.7 billion Muslims in the world, and you'll probably get about 1.7 billion different answers to that question, depending on on who you're talking to, where they live, what their circumstances are, their socioeconomic status, level of education, and on and on and on. But generally, I think that normative teachings, normative understandings of Islam, are men and women equal, absolutely equal in their rights, in their from the very beginning. Muslims, according to Quranic verses and literature, men and women are born from the same spiritual source. So their nature and their humanity are the same. And it begins there. The story of men and women begins in that story. And this is where we get the equality. They have the same responsibilities. They have, they're both going to be held accountable the same way. They have the same obligations. They're both considered to be vice regents of God on earth. So in terms of equality and their equal access, they have equal access to God, equal obligations. And then the rights basically stem from that. Now, how that unfolds in society really depends very much on their circumstances, where they live. There are 50 Muslim majority countries in the world, and each of those countries have their own set of laws, and those rights tend to flow from those laws, the state's laws. And like here in the United States, our men and women's rights stem from federal and state laws. And then how they understand their religion and how that's interpreted.
Let me go to Sambul. Sambul, what would your response be if I asked you if men and women were equal?
In the eyes of God.
In the eyes of God?
I'd say yes.
And in the understanding of Islam as it is commonly understood
by the 1.7 million practitioners understanding
billion.
That, excuse me, 1.7 billion mm-hmm. Followers understanding that each of them will have their own interpretation of their faith.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are two different ways to look at it. So the Quran has universal verses that talk about fairness and justice. And in those verses, the Quran has many verses that put men and women on an equal basis. So there are many verses that say believing men and believing women should blah, blah, blah. Devout men and devout women should. So for a 7th century religious text, it was really remarkable for the Quran to be pulling out specifically women and not just assuming that they were included in the you. You know, it doesn't say you will go to heaven if you do particular things. It says men and women will go to heaven if they do particular things. So that's one thing. The second thing, you know, I have to tell you that when I was a corporate lawyer, when I was working as a corporate lawyer, I was no different from any other woman corporate lawyer in terms of my career or in terms of my educational opportunities. And I wasn't breaking any Islamic laws by being there as a corporate lawyer. So,
yeah.
So let me ask a question then of both of you. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Sure.
But mm-hmm. why is this a question then? I asked
question.
The question. It was the first question I asked.
Yeah.
I asked it because there certainly is a popular understanding that is somewhat at odds with the description you two have just given.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think part of the reason is that there is a historical lens through which medieval Europeans always looked at Islam, through the lens of, you know, foreignness and hostility. Islam is a false religion. Something that all religions do is view religions that come after them as false religions. And so there was always this lens of this negative lens through which medieval Europeans were looking at Islam, and mm-hmm. that permeated our culture and our literature. By our, I mean Western European culture and literature. In America, we inherited this lens from the British. So there's always been a presumption when it comes to looking at Islam that there's something negative. Muslims are foreign, Muslims are different. So if you have that lens, then facts that you get, you're going to make fit that lens. So, for example, you know, people might look at Yemen and say, oh, look how oppressed Yemeni women are, that therefore Islam is oppressive. Whereas they wouldn't look at Guatemala and say, look at all those women in Guatemala who are in sexual slavery. Look how oppressive Christianity is. Mm-hmm. It's a different way of looking at the world.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think the construction of knowledge about the Muslim world comes from the colonialist period, which is exactly what Sumbul was just talking about. Knowledge about other people is constructed. It's never objective. Never objective. And so the construction of knowledge about the Muslim world, about the Arab world, was such that it's been carried forward to this day, which is now modern-day Islamophobia. But also, I think the media is a big problem. The media tends to focus on very sensationalist news. And if you look at how the media portrays, for example, China, Russia, especially now, Latin American countries, African nations, right? There are these paradigms, these narratives that they only report about. When it comes to Muslims, when it comes to the Arab world, it's usually about oppression of women or terrorism, right? Somebody like Sumbul would never be on, I mean, it's rarely, I never see people like Sumbul on television representing Muslims, and she probably represents the majority of American Muslims who do not, you know, most Muslim women do not wear the hijab like you see me wearing. But we don't see people like Sumbul. Now, if Sumbul was burning the American flag, you know, saying down with America, she would absolutely be on Fox News, right? Because it fits a narrative, it fits a paradigm. And so, and that's the problem, I think, that, and it's not just about the Middle East and about Muslims. I think that you'll find that with the way that the media tends to cover certain parts of the world. But the construction of knowledge is where it begins, and that's exactly what Sumbul was talking about.
Sumbul, when I asked this initial question about equality, you made reference to verses in the Quran. Mm-hmm. I am going to guess, and I'm pretty sure I'm going to guess right, that we're going to get some questions tonight that will cite specific references in the Quran that are sure. contrary to that view of equality, that mm-hmm. Make the argument that equality is not what the Quran and Islam are about. How do you respond to those? And before you do, could I ask folks to please be quiet in the audience and respect everyone up there as well as the folks who are up here? Thanks so much.
Yeah, so the Quran has, again, two different kinds of verses. And one kind of verse is the universal general verses, fairness and justice and do good things. But the Quran also has specific responses to that particular historical period. So the universal verses are always applicable, right? The specific verses that apply to the particular historical period may not be, because what's relevant in Islamic law is looking at the reason for revelation. What was the reason for revelation for this particular verse? And very often, the ones that, you know, the verses that come up are the ones that were in response to a particular historical period. So, can I give an example?
Please.
So, for example, inheritance. This is the 7th century in Arabia. Y'all have read Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice? That was, you know, 19th century. And you know that Elizabeth Bennet and her sisters got nothing because the entire estate was entailed to the nearest male heir, right? Mm-hmm.
There is no pop quiz after this section, by the way.
So this was England in the 19th century. So in the 7th century, women really didn't inherit anything. So in 7th century Arabian culture, in fact, it was a tribal culture where everything went to the strongest male heir, because that male heir was the one who was going to war. He was taking care of the entire tribe. So in this culture came a verse that said, well, there are many inheritance verses, but one of them said, if you have a son and a daughter and you die, then 2/3 of the estate goes to your son and 1/3 goes to your daughter. Now, 1/3 of the estate in the 7th century was huge. Remember Jane Austen, right? It was huge in the 7th century, and there was a lot of resistance. Like, why does my sister get 1/3? You know, she doesn't take care of the tribe. She doesn't go to war. But at the time, it was really generous. Now, the reason for revelation, again, was that particular time period where women didn't have that much power. They didn't take care of the tribe. The reason for revelation is no longer applicable. So that verse can be reevaluated. So modern interpretation of Islamic law would say, no, you can give half and half to your son and daughter.
So part of part of the answer is the importance of historic context.
Yep.
Maha, you referenced the fact that there are 50-plus Muslim-majority nations, mm-hmm. and I inferred from that you wanted us to be mindful of the culture in those 50 different...
And the diversity, that Muslims are not monolithic, and just the same way that Christians are not monolithic, there are 2 billion Christians in the world. Catholics in America, in the United States, are very different than Roman Catholics, very different than African, than Latin American Catholics. And so, and I think that that's the way that we also need to look at Muslims. Muslims are diverse based on where they live, based on, you know, the ideological framework that they operate under in terms of their Islamic scholarship, based on the politics of that country, and then based on the individual, you know, how much education they have, you know, what their economic status is, and so all of those factors impact their reading and their understanding of the religion of Islam. So even in the verse that Sumbul mentioned, many different interpretations. Conservative Muslims may not want to change that verse.
May want to
because it's there. They have to deal with it, and that's where the tension comes in. Where, you know, in the modern context, this may not apply, but there's room to sort of change what is written in the Quran depending on. So mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. There is room, but some will say no. We don't. You know, we can't because it's in the Quran. And therefore, we actually have to follow
it. So there are literalists in every religion, right? There are people who take the Bible literally and people who don't. So that's in every religious community. What I often say is if you really want to look at whether Muslim women are oppressed, then why compare American non-Muslim women to Muslim women overseas? You know, compare, if you want to compare apples and apples, compare American Muslim women to American non-Muslim women, right? Because then you're factoring in all the cultural and economic and sociological aspects. If you're comparing If you want to compare.
And if we did that comparison, what would we see?
You're asking
Muslim women
Muslim
women are the second most educated women in the country next to Jewish American women.
That's right. Plus,
that's true. They're highly educated, more than Protestant.
Well, based on your two resumes, I'm inclined to believe it. But that's Sumbul. What else you did?
Oh, just that Muslim women also have the most parity of any faith group in the United States. Parity of income with men. So Muslim women and Muslim men have almost equal incomes. More mm-hmm. equal than any other faith group. And Muslim women, American Muslim women are actually far more likely to get a graduate degree than American Muslim men are.
Yeah. All right. I want to make sure that folks who have questions raise their hands high, because we do have folks who are coming down the aisle. And I want to try and parse a little bit the difference between that which is religiously prescribed, required, or prohibited, and that which is essentially a cultural norm. Mm-hmm. And let's go to a couple of hot button issues right away. Honor killings.
Oh, wow.
Nothing to do
with the religion of Islam. Absolutely
right.
Nothing to do with the religion of Islam. Nothing.
That's right.
You know, there are some men that may claim that, you know, this is my right, and, you know, I protect this woman, and there, and she violated my honor, and therefore I can kill her. It's nonsense. It's completely far-fetched. Nothing to do with the religion of Islam.
So under Islamic law, you can never kill anybody except in legitimate warfare, which has very stringent rules of engagement, or if it's a death penalty case where someone has had a fair trial. Yeah. But you can't just go and kill people in Islam. And in fact, honor killings happen in any community where a woman's chastity is connected with the family's honor. So,
right.
honor, you know, you've all... So I'm an English literature major, so I read lots of books where a European woman was kicked out of the house or beaten to death because she got pregnant, right? This happened through the centuries in Europe.
In India, in Latin American countries.
In India, you know, women who are Hindu have been killed because they've married outside of their caste. In Latin America, the courts have been very lenient with respect to honor killings. And in fact, until the 1990s, it was actually a defense on the books in Brazil that if you committed a murder, you could say that you committed an honor killing, and that would be a defense to murder. So it's something that is very common. In the Caribbean, there are men who throw acid in the faces of women who leave them. So it's mm-hmm. any community where a woman's chastity is perceived as connected to the family's honor.
And in places where it happens, in Jordan or Pakistan, the men are actually brought to court, and they are charged with a crime, and they have to face a judge for that crime.
I want to come back to this topic in a minute, but let me go on to another difficult conversation, which has to do with female circumcision, also known as female genital mutilation, FGM. Mm. This is an issue that gets raised again in the context of discussions about Islam. Mm-hmm. Does Islam have a view on the subject?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if I should talk about this in public, but... sexual satisfaction for a woman in a marriage is actually one of her rights. Okay, think about that. Sexual satisfaction of a woman in a marriage is one of her rights. So a man can't just, you know...
assert himself.
Yeah. Assert himself. I like that.
Awkward.
Cannot assert himself without making sure that... she's you know, agreeing to it, and there's, you know, stuff that is involved. Maybe you can talk about this better than me, Sumbul. But the woman, you know,
in the category of conversations I did not anticipate having this evening, this would rank high on the list. But it is,
it is a serious and important
subject.
And so circumcision restricts that sexual stimulation of a woman. FGM is totally criminal. I mean, it's a brutal crime. So both, of course, are absolutely abhorred and condemned. Doesn't happen in Muslim majority countries. It does in places like Egypt, where I was born. It actually happens there, and it happens in African society. But the practice predates Islam.
And yet, go ahead, Sumbul.
Oh, so yes. In fact, Female genital cutting goes back to the pharaohs. It predates Islam. It's practiced by as many Christians in Egypt as Muslims. It's practiced primarily in Africa. So a lot of women in Africa have been subject to this practice, whereas in other Muslim countries, they've never heard of it. You know, in Pakistan, it's never done. In Jordan, and...
One moment, please. I don't want to have to ask anyone to leave. Please, respect the rights of those who came to listen and respect the courtesy that we owe our two speakers. Last time. Go right ahead.
So, you know, if it were an Islamic practice, it would be practiced throughout all Muslim countries. But it isn't. It's practiced primarily in Africa. I work with a group that promotes women's rights from an Islamic perspective. So what we did is put together, it was a group of a variety of scholars, and we put together a position paper on female genital cutting and came at it from lots of from a religious perspective, a human rights perspective, and we put together a position paper that could be translated and used in various places around the world. So it's being used in Africa to explain to people that it's not an Islamic practice and it's not healthy and they need to stop. So a few years ago I heard that there was a consortium of 14 villages who had taken an oath to not perform this practice anymore in those villages, and they were going out and trying to get more to join them. So it was very inspiring.
All right, let's go to the very visible issue, and for some, a visible manifestation of difference.
Hijab.
Hijab? Niqab? Burqa? Who'd like to explain the difference between it among the three? And then let's talk a little bit about what they do or don't represent in Islam.
Mm-hmm. Islamic law is not one thing. It's not statutory and enforceable, which is how we think of law. It's a mass of guidelines and arguments and debates and opinions. So there are thousands of books of Islamic law, and they're just opinions over the centuries by scholars on various topics, various legal topics. So when it comes to the issue of women, there are all kinds of opinions. Women in clothing, I should say. And actually, there are lots of opinions on men in clothing as well. It wasn't just with respect to women, because the Quran says men should be modest and women should be modest. And men should lower their eyes in modesty and women should lower their eyes in modesty. But we don't have a lot of conversations about men's modesty, do we? But with respect to women, there's a whole lot of opinions. What they all agreed on was that women should be covered from their shoulders to their knees. That's not that different from modern notions of modesty, actually, even though this was over 1,000 years ago. But beyond that, they disagreed. So some said only the hands, face, and feet should show. But then some said, well, what does that mean? Is hand from the wrist or is hand from the elbow? Is feet from the ankle or is feet from the knee? Does chest start at the neck or at the cleavage? You know, there are all kinds of opinions about this. And at the bottom of it, you know, these were all opinions, so that means they were fatwas. And at the end of the fatwa, these scholars would always say, but God knows best, meaning that I might be right, but he might be right instead. So we're just going to assume that only God really knows for sure. So as a Muslim, you can decide which opinion you want to follow within those parameters. They're all valid. So these are all valid interpretations of Islam. And so the burqa, or the niqab, which is the face veils, the vast majority of scholars say, are not Islamic and also predate Islam from a time when everybody wore something across their face to keep the sand out. This was the desert, remember. So I got a call from... This is telling my story. I got a call from CNN on the day that the burqa ban went into effect in France. And the CNN producer said, what do you think of the burqa ban? And I said, it predates Islam. The majority of Islamic scholars don't think it is Islamic. But if a woman wants to wear it and thinks it's her religious duty, then I think she should be able to. And the producer said, we wanted someone who was in favor of the burqa ban. Thanks anyway.
That's what I'm talking
okay.
about.
So.
Maha, your thoughts on this subject?
It's a vast subject. I think that Sumbul did a great job in explaining the differences of opinion. I follow sort of more conservative opinion on this, where I do believe that it's required to cover the way that you see me covered, except for the face and hands, which is one of the opinions that you cited. And the idea behind it, and you know, my clothing is very loose fitting and so forth. So the idea behind it is to conceal sexuality, and it also sort of dictates the way that I interact with men, which is supposed to be free of sexuality. And if, you know, if sexuality or if I'm attracted to someone or someone's attracted to me, it's not something that I would ever engage in or pursue outside of a marriage. So it's not just about dress. It's really about a way of life as well. That's the idea behind it. Of course, I work with men daily. One of my male colleagues is here, actually. I work with men all the time, and I manage men. I'm friends with men. But it's a relationship that is free of sexuality, and dress is very much part of that, and that's the reason for it.
So here
is it oppressive?
Go ahead. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Is it oppressive? It would be if I was forced to wear my hijab. This is by choice. My husband actually would sometimes, you know, when things are getting bad in the country around Islamophobia, he would prefer that I don't, because he thinks that it's, you know, dangerous for me to stand out the way that I do, wearing the hijab. But most people don't even know what this is. They think I'm just having a bad hair day, and this is a scarf that I'm wearing, you know, and it kind of matches, you know, and, you know, people don't know. So I don't worry about it. So I think if it's a choice, then it's not oppressive. In some countries, it's not a choice. In Saudi Arabia, I've been to Saudi Arabia, and in Iran, a woman has to wear. But we're talking about two out of how many Muslim-majority countries? And as Sumbul pointed out earlier, you know, people usually define Islam by the worst aspects, worst elements of it. They see one story in the media and they define Islam by that. And so I think that it's also the responsibility of Americans of other faith to learn about us. How many are we here? 5 to 7 million in the entire country. I think it's really incumbent upon Americans to learn, because domestic policy is based on these stereotypes. Foreign policies are determined by these stereotypes, not just about Muslims and Arabs, but about other nations as well.
Why do you think, both here in the United States, but also abroad, where attire has been legislated, why do you think this is such a hot button issue? I mean, at
for the women, or
for the culture, for American culture and for other cultures abroad.
I think it's the way it's portrayed here in the media.
I think also that it's visible, and even under colonization, it was something that it was easy to point to because you can see it. You know, you can't really tell if someone is a devout Muslim otherwise, but you can see this. By the way, I just wanted to add two things to what Maha said. One is that I think it's just as oppressive to prevent women from wearing a headscarf.
That's true.
As it is to force them to wear a headscarf.
Yeah.
And secondly, you all probably heard Donald Trump's speech in Saudi Arabia.
Probably not.
if you saw it on the television, maybe you noticed that all the Saudi men were just as covered up as the Saudi women.
Yeah.
You know, this is really not a sexist issue.
Well, let me take note of what I found an interesting debate, which is in an effort to show solidarity, some American women have taken to wearing, non-Muslim American women have taken to wearing the hijab, in order to show their support.
Mm-hmm.
Others have, from within the Muslim community, have come and said, No. This is something that the fundamentalists or the traditionalists or the conservatives are pushing, forcing, and therefore you're lending support to their efforts, which are in fact hostile to the free choice of Muslim women in America or in other cultures. Mm-hmm. You have a reaction to that?
Yep. I think always have a reaction.
And that reaction would be what, Sumbul?
So the reaction is, if someone has such good faith and good intentions to want to put something on their head in solidarity, I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, I think if someone wants to be, wants to show support, then I think that's a wonderful thing, whatever form it takes.
Asra, I know who you're talking about. It's Asra Nomani, who's a friend. I've spoken with Asra Nomani on a couple of panels, and I think what her concern is, in all fairness to her, is that she's saying that if you make this required, if you put out that one point of view, you talk about many different points of views on this issue. Mm-hmm. If you push that one point of view out there, then women who don't wear the scarf, don't wear the hijab, may feel like they're not good Muslims or they're less of Muslims.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And so the way that she wants to sort of make that point is to say, you know, don't reinforce the idea that you can only be Muslim if you wear the hijab, and you do that by wearing the scarf. Sort of that's the argument that she's making, and I think there is a little bit of validity in her argument. Unfortunately, the conversation is just not happening like it should in the Muslim community. You know what I mean?
And I understand that. You know, as someone who has never worn a headscarf, sometimes I am perceived as non-compliant.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, oh, you must be a secular Muslim, or you must be non-compliant, or you must be breaking the rules of your religion. And I'm not. I'm just taking one interpretation and following that one. And very often, you know, on television too, mm-hmm. like anybody watch Quantico? And well, not too many. So Quantico, there's an Arab woman who plays twins, and one twin wears a headscarf and the other one doesn't. And they're both fighting terrorism. Like, there are no normal Muslim people on television. Mm-hmm. She's the closest, but she's still fighting terrorism. But what's interesting and not right is that the woman who wears a headscarf does all the other things too. She prays, she's right. modest. The woman who doesn't wear the headscarf drinks, mm-hmm. sleeps with men, you know, wears like totally revealing clothes. So it's not just like one or the other, people. You know, there's a wide range.
Yeah. That's a great example.
So yeah. I'm going to anticipate the answer to the question, but I want to ask it on the record anyway. What would you say if someone asked you, is someone who wears the hijab more devout than someone who doesn't?
Oh, God, no.
No.
No. The answer is absolutely not. Yeah. It's about a relationship with God. No one knows who's a friend of God, and it's a personal relationship that one has. No one sees you praying. No one sees you fasting and doing all of the things that is required of a Muslim. So you should never, never judge someone's religiosity, particularly a woman's religiosity of any faith, by the way that she dresses. That's a personal choice, and we should leave women alone in that personal choice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a number of questions, and thank you for your questions. And if you haven't had your questions picked up yet, please just raise them one more time, because we want to make sure we get to them if we possibly can. We have a number of questions about the status of women in society and second-class citizenship, subjugation of women, Saudi Arabia, driving. Your thoughts about the role of women in Islamic communities, both here and abroad. Mm-hmm. And I think we may be back to the culture versus faith conversation.
And also, I think that we need to understand that not every Saudi woman opposes the fact that she can't drive. I think there are Saudi women that are very comfortable not driving and having drivers and being driven around. So I don't think that we should assume or impose our values on other cultures and other nations. Not that Americans ever do that towards other people, but we just shouldn't assume that everybody necessarily agrees with us or has the same values on these issues. I'll begin by the fact that there are a dozen Muslim majority countries that have had female presidents. Okay? A dozen. Shamsu Schiller of Turkey, Benazir Bhutto of Pakistan, Bangladesh has had two women presidents, Indonesia has had a woman president, Mali, Senegal, Kosovo, right? Several. Right.
Presidents or prime ministers, heads of state.
Right.
So at least 11 Muslim heads of state of Muslim countries. We haven't had a woman president here yet.
I think it very much depends on the country and the environment and the history and the traditions of the everything is based on the location that you're in. You also have women that are part of parliament in places like Iraq. More women in parliament than we have women here in Congress. What percent of Congress is women? 20%. 20%. It actually went up thanks to groups like, I forget the name of the group, that puts women... Emily's List, which did a great job in getting a lot of women in Congress, but we still have about 20%. I don't know if it's still 20%, but the last time I checked, you have more women in Parliament in places like Iraq and in other parts of the Muslim world. You've had even in Iran, we've had a female vice president. There are more women educated in Iran today than there were under the Shah of Iran. So it's a mixed bag. You have some that, you know, it's, in some situations, it actually they do better.
Sumble?
Oh, just there are more women than men in universities and
in
quite
STEM
a few Muslim-majority countries. In Saudi Arabia, there are more Muslim women than men. In the UAE, in Jordan.
Especially in STEM fields. In science, technology, engineering.
Mm-hmm. And yet, to the extent that women may be marginalized in some of these Muslim-majority countries we're talking about, is your view that this is primarily a function of culture rather than faith-based?
Well, you know, I think it's important to remember that most Muslim-majority countries are developing countries. And they have all the problems of every other developing country. You know, the problems in the Middle East are very similar to the problems in Latin America. But the problems in Latin America are not portrayed as Christian problems, even though those are Christian majority countries. So, you know, developing countries, when you have poverty, when you have pre-modern societies, women do suffer disproportionately. So, for example, you've always I'm sorry. All of you have probably heard about the Taliban burning girls' schools in Pakistan, right? But I know people who work with organizations that build girls' schools in Pakistan, and they say by far the reason that it's hard to get girls educated in Pakistan is poverty. Yeah, the Taliban burned a couple of schools, and that's always across the news. But the biggest problem is poverty. Why? Because if you have to leave your family and go to another village to get your daughter educated, it's not going to happen. If you can't afford to get your daughter, if you can only afford to get one child educated, then you're going to probably pick your son because you think he's going to have more of a chance of succeeding. So that is the biggest problem. You know, in Pakistan, in the cities where women have wealth and resources, they're just as prevalent in the professional fields as men are. You know, there are women who practice at the Supreme Court of Pakistan, one of whom I know. The head of Human Rights Watch in Pakistan was a woman. So it's a matter of poverty and pre-modern societies rather than religion.
Maha, I want to go back to something you said a little bit earlier, and it's a question or a to which there may not be an answer, but I think it would be helpful to hear from the two of you nonetheless. You suggested and this is my reformulation, so you feel free to correct my reformulation if need be, but I thought I heard you suggest that we need to be a little careful about our imposing our own American perspectives and mm-hmm. values on other countries and other cultures and other faiths. Mm-hmm. And this is an interesting debate that plays out between those who talk about cultural relativism, and usually in a disparaging tone, suggesting that we have simply abandoned our own views and values and morals and sort of accepted whatever is out there as somehow acceptable. Others on the other side of the debate suggest that it's important that we not be ethnocentric, which is a little more where I think you were headed, meaning that we not impose our own views and values and moral judgments. Mm-hmm. And yet, if I look out in the room or think about our listening audience, whose views and values are we going to work from if not our own?
Absolutely.
So where do we go in that conversation about Islam and mm-hmm. judgment? Is there a Is there a how-to guide in terms of balancing the two or resolving that debate?
I think if a crime is being committed, if oppression is taking place, and people are calling us to help them, I think we have an obligation to do that, right? We're making assumptions that the hijab is oppressive, for example, or that Saudi women, for example, all of them, there are women that have protested the fact that the ban that they can't drive, a handful of women, and it's a feminist organization, and they've gone out there and protested. And I think it's eventually going to change. I know that it will change. Saudi Arabia wasn't always like this. You know, this is all in the last maybe 20, 30 years as a result of the spread of a particular ideology. But just I just think it's important that we not make an assumption that these women are oppressed just because they have different values or different ways of dress, different religion, different ideas about all sorts of things. And I think that's where I'm coming from. If oppression is taking place and they're calling us for help, I think we should help. It's the assumption that we make about other cultures, based on our own values. And not recognizing, for example, just one more point,
sure.
Not recognizing, for example, that in the Catholic tradition here, women still cannot be clergy, and that they don't have religious the same equal rights that men do in the Catholic tradition. Why the focus only on Muslim women and Islam as being the source of all oppression towards women? Why are we not looking at issues that we confront here in the United States?
Perhaps that's also that will be our next series.
An interfaith panel.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to take you off track.
Yeah.
Sambul, do you have thoughts on this same subject, the sort of cultural relativism versus ethnocentrism? How do we exercise, some intelligent judgment without drawing on our own views, values, experiences, as a starting point?
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a really good book. If you want to know what Muslims think, there's a book called Who Speaks for Islam by John Esposito and Dalia Mogahed. And that's the results of the 2006 World Gallup poll that was taken. And they asked them all sorts of things. Like they asked Saudi women if they want to drive. And actually, I think it was 67% who said that they actually do want to drive. Mm. They look at how many women are in professional fields, in universities. They look at all sorts of other issues that don't have to do with women as well. So it's called Who Speaks for Islam, and it's just the result of the World Gallup poll by John Esposito. So I would recommend looking at that. Also, I'm a lawyer. I come from a place of Islamic law, right? So that's my perspective. And when Islam was revealed in the 7th century, when Islam was revealed in the 7th century, it was a feminist religion. So it is
feminist in the sense that it gave women rights that they didn't have.
Right. So, mm-hmm. So Islam, for example, gave women the right to divorce. It gave women custody of their small children. Mm-hmm. It gave them the right to enter into their own contracts. They could contract their own marriages. They had a maintenance and support requirement. In fact, Norman Daniel is a historian, and he says that in the 7th century, Islam and the Quran, well, actually, the Prophet and the Quran gave women more rights in 7th century Arabia than English women would have for another 1,000 years. Until the 19th century Married Women's Property Act. So before the Married Women's Property Act in England, women could not own their own property. They could not. They were not legal entities, whereas 7th century Arab Muslim women were. So that was tremendously progressive. And to take that progressive law and somehow to limit it and restrict women with it, I think is a tragedy. And should not be the case. The Quran introduced 9 new heirs to the scheme of intestate succession. almost all of them women. So before that, you know, women couldn't inherit. Remember Jane Austen? You know, nobody, women couldn't inherit until the 19th century in most European countries. And yet, the Quran said that if there is a daughter, a mother, a sister, all these women had mandatory portions that they inherited. So that was really remarkable.
Maha, earlier you anticipated actually a number of questions that we have here from our audience about women and men and the way they worship, whether or not men and women are permitted to worship with one another, whether or not women are allowed to play leadership roles, can they be prayer leaders, imams? What is the current state of gender equity within Islam in terms of the practice of the faith? And I know we talked about this a little bit at a prior session, but I think it's worth revisiting in a little more depth.
But I don't know if there's a specific question there, but are men and women, do men and women have the same requirements in worship? Absolutely. And we talked earlier about accountability as well. So do they pray together? Absolutely, they pray together. There are different forms of prayer. There is the supplication, I ask God for things. There is the using the beads, remembrances of God. So men and women pray together. There is the canonized prayer called Salat, which is of the formal prayer that men and women have to do five times a day. They pray in the same hall, in a mosque. They're separated because the Muslim prayer is physical in nature, right? I have to, when I'm praying in congregation with a woman, I have to touch the woman next to me, touch the person next to me. And then there's a series of bowing and bending over and bowing. And so it's more comfortable to me, quite frankly, as an American woman who is a feminist, who is, you know, quite assertive and strong. I prefer to be with women in that position, not with men or standing in front of men. So that's why the separation happens in the prayer hall, but in the rest of the community center, they interact with each other.
Sumbul, do I remember correctly that you had a slightly different take on this in terms of in the prayer hall, the separation?
So oftentimes when I think non-Muslims look at Muslim culture, they do think if there's a difference in men and women, it must be sexism. And I think in this case, it's more matters of modesty. It's like it's what's modest and comfortable is when you're concentrating mm-hmm. on your prayer, then you shouldn't be thinking, oh, there's a strange man that I'm touching. And I'm not very comfortable, so you shouldn't be thinking that way. On the other hand, I do feel like, and when it comes to women standing and praying in front of men, I do feel like that men should be looking at the carpet on the ground and not in front of them at the women's backside. So, but you know, there are a variety of views on this too. So, men and women usually pray in the same room. You know, there are sometimes for space. Because of space limitations, they pray in different rooms. But, I go to a center where we all pray in the same room. There's a question over whether a woman could lead a prayer. Mm-hmm. So in very early Islam, the Prophet made a woman the imam of her household. So there's nothing not religious in that. A woman can be a prayer leader of her own household and certainly of other women. There's a question of whether she can be a prayer leader of other men. Because again, it's that same thing about a woman would be up in front of the crowd and men would be looking at her bending over. And that's not such a, that could be a distracting thing. So, mm-hmm. but, you know, sheikhs, very high-level sheikhs have said, yes, a woman can lead a group of both men and women, especially if she stands off to the mm-hmm. side where the women are.
So, some commentators have pushed back on this and said, look, why are the requirements of modesty, why are the requirements of separation, why are the prohibitions on full participation there as they affect women when the concern is about the men's behavior?
Well, yeah,
that's
exactly to what extent are the women bearing the burden of the concern about the men's behavior, or potential distraction.
Yeah,
right. So, no, I don't think they should be. I think everybody should have their eyes on the ground. Thank you very much.
Can I just jump in and say that I don't wear the hijab for the sake of men. I really can care less what a man does, how he looks at me, and how he regards me. That's his problem. That isn't mine. I don't dress this way for the sake of men. I dress this way, and I believe in what I believe in for my own sake, for my own closeness and nearness to God. I feel very comfortable. All men and women have to cover, have to dress modestly when they're praying. And women, even if they don't wear hijab outside, do cover when they are in a state of prayer. I want to be in that state all the time. That's why I dress the way that I do. And I think it's very comfortable. I wear flats. I wear loose-fitting clothing. I don't worry about how I look in my clothing because it's very comfortable. It's very roomy. And I focus on what is important in life. And it's not my looks. And it's not my physical appearance. So I don't do it for men. I really don't do it for men. And I don't think that you should assume that that is the case or that the rules are based on that. I think that's an explanation that some people give, being ignorant of why modesty is important. Modesty is important for both men and women. It's not just a female thing. So I think that's really important to keep in mind. And women have religious leadership. There are more women scholars in the American Muslim community today than I think that there are men. A number of women that have gone into academia studying religion. There are a number of women that run chaplaincy programs that have become chaplains, that are leading communities on campuses, that are chaplains in hospitals. I think eventually women are going to be given the title of imam because women already perform pastoral activities. They help in funerals. They help in spiritual counseling. They teach. They visit the sick. So they do a lot of the things that clerics or imams already do. They can also lead the prayer, as Sumbul pointed out, of women. Where maybe Sumbul and I may disagree. I don't know if we disagree at all or not. But it would be difficult for a woman to lead the prayer of men, standing in front of men, unless she's standing in front of the women and the men are standing in somewhere else, right? And she's standing in front of the women and she's performing.
And women side by side,
yeah.
And the woman in front of the women's side,
yeah.
is how it's been.
Yeah, but as
described.
Far as women giving lectures, as far as women getting up on, on panels and speaking, we do it all the time. We do it all the time in the mosque, so we already have the religious leadership. The vast majority of Muslim schools in this country are run by female principals. The vast majority of the NGOs in this country are run by women. ING is one of them, and all of our affiliates are run by women. So women are already representing Muslim communities. It's the issue of modesty that that is very important to our faith, as it is to many faiths, and it's not for the sake of the other. It's for our own sake.
We've got a couple of questions about Islam and the marriage contract or relationship, depending on who the questioner
subject.
Is. So understanding that there is civil marriage, but understanding also that Islam speaks to this issue, what should we know about a woman's rights, role, responsibilities, place in a marriage under Islam?
Did you want to comment?
It was your favorite subject.
It's my favorite, because I have a marriage contract. I actually we have a civil marriage,
well,
and then
so I
go ahead.
I've met one of the lawyers in Pakistan who practices at the Supreme Court of Pakistan, and one of the things that she does is she goes out into the villages and educates people on the marriage contract, because very often people in the villages, you have to understand, Pakistan has an over 50% illiteracy rate, and it's in the villages. Mm-hmm. So they don't really know, what their rights are under Islam. And she goes out there and she says, here are your rights. You shouldn't just cave in and, ask for your rights. So it is a civil contract. It's not a really, like a, what do you call it? Like a
A sacrament?
A sacrament, yes. Mm-hmm. It's not a sacred thing. It's a civil contract like any other contract. But a woman, for example, can put in any conditions she wants into her marriage contract. Mm-hmm. The Quran never says that women must obey their husbands. So it's, you know, as in American law, you know, you can't put in a condition that violates the purpose of the contract, right? But anything else, you can.
Yeah. So it really depends. And some of the contracts are hilarious. So I studied religion, and I looked at some of the older contracts that women had, and some of them were hilarious as far as the stipulation. One, for example, that I remember that always cracks me up is a woman who made a comment about her husband's mother, who she didn't like. And she said, you know, I know that I have to see your mother, but I don't want to see her when I'm at home. So my stipulation in the contract was that she can come to the home and visit him while she's out of the home, like on Fridays. I mean, women actually like had these types of conversations with their husbands before marriage that they put in their contract. It's similar to the chutubah that Jews also, Jewish families also do. It's actually like a prenuptial, but it's not a financial agreement where you have these conversations with your husband about, you know, one of the things that I put in my contract, my husband is Pakistani, and he's an immigrant, and I wanted to make sure that that he understood that I didn't want to live outside of the United States, and that I have a job because I started this organization, and I wanted to continue to do the work that I was doing, and I didn't want to live outside of the Bay Area as well. I mean, I put everything in there. Women can sort of put anything that they want in there. And it was, no, it saved my marriage. I honestly say that because, you know, these issues come up in marriage. You know, to stay in a marriage, you have to negotiate, right? It's all about negotiations, back and forth negotiations. And these issues came up for my husband. You know, hey, I want to move to Pakistan. Hey, I want to move to Texas. The houses are cheaper over there. You know, we can have a better standard of living and so forth, which were all legitimate reasons. But I referred him to the contract. and it was beautiful. And we've been married for 21 years, you know, as a result of that. But there are other rights that we can talk about in terms of, you know, there are religious rights that women have, and one of them is financial support, which is amazing for women. And I'll tell you why, because women, when they begin to have children, many of them decide to stay home, not just for a short while, but maybe they'll stay home for a year or 2 years. And if the woman is working and she keeps her income, it doesn't impact the family's standard of living when she decides to stay home. And he has that financial obligation, which is related to what we started with when we talked about inheritance laws, and so that's one of many rights that she has.
Mm-hmm. You're both women in America in the 21st century. You're both Muslim women in America in the 21st century. How is that different, if at all, from being a Christian woman, a Jewish woman, an atheist woman, an agnostic woman, a secular woman, a Hindu woman, a Baha'i, and on and on and on? How is that different than the experience, if it is, than the experience that American women of other faiths feel?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I tell people is that I have a lot more in common with my American non-Muslim friends than I ever would with a Muslim woman in, say, Uganda. Because culture is, I think, stronger than religion. Culture forms us, our environment forms us, right? We're all products of our environment. Mm-hmm. And that is the major thing that operates on us. It's not religion. Religion is always interpreted through the lens of culture. And, you know, when I was doing my degree in Islamic law, my professor, who is a Lebanese Christian man, at one point said, Islam is a lot more fluid than people think. And it's really true. I mean, we all grow up with our family versions of religion, right? And those things are pretty much the same. I mean, all the Muslims I grew up with were taught pretty much, don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat, don't, you know, be respectful to your parents, work hard in school, Mm-hmm. Right? And that's what we pretty much all grow up with. I mean, I didn't ever come across this idea that Islam was sexist until I was a corporate lawyer. I mean, what? What are you talking about? I mean, my parents nagged me and nagged me and nagged me to be a physician. I was a grave disappointment to them that I went to law school. So, you know, that was their big thing. I mean, people assume, oh, you're Muslim, your parents must have wanted to marry you off. No, my parents wanted me to go to medical school.
Yeah.
So it was only until, you know, when I was practicing as a corporate lawyer where someone said to me, you don't think Islam is sexist? And there I was, a fellow corporate lawyer. So it was amazing to me.
Yeah.
Maha?
Not that there aren't men that are not sexist. There are men that are sexist. I mean, you have patriarchy, you know, existing in all religions, and I think you have it also in you know, in the Muslim community as well. And the way that you deal with it is you you know, just quote verse and chapter and tell them to get out of your way. Basically, you know, and so, and I've confronted quite a bit of that in the Muslim community where, you know, when I first started becoming active, I would be told things like, you know, sister, what are you doing in the mosque? Doing, passing out flyers, you should be home, pregnant, married, you know. It was hilarious.
Maha, immigrants?
They were mostly immigrants.
Yeah,
they were
so
mostly immigrants.
That's the thing. That Muslims who come here, like everybody else who comes here, they all bring their cultural baggage, right? If they've grown up in a small town in Italy or Lebanon or wherever, they think that that's the way that you're supposed to do things, and that's what they bring here. So
yeah, but my point is that in every religious community, in every community of any kind, there are going to be people that are going to have you know, different views, conservative views, and we have them just as much as anybody else does. And so as Americans, of course, you know, as an American coming from a corporate background, and you know, I wasn't going to sort of put up with that, and I did it. I you know, negotiated and I debated and was able to do exactly what I've been doing for the last 25 years for the American Muslim community. You go into any mosque today, and I highly recommend, Ramadan is coming up in about a week, and every mosque in the Bay Area has a Ramadan open house, an interfaith Ramadan open house. And this is your opportunity to actually meet Muslims like me and Sumbul, for you to see that we're not special or, well, we're just different or we're exclusive. You know, this is we're pretty typical American Muslims, and I think it's an opportunity for you to actually meet and interact with different Muslims from different parts of the world as well.
I need to interject because we have time for just one last question.
Sure.
And I want to please, ma'am, please. Let it go, please. The last question is, and I'd like to actually, the last question is about your youth as young Muslim women, girls, Maha, I know you were born in Cairo. I don't know how old you were when you left Cairo.
Seven.
But, you know, in any community, there's sort of an understanding of what it is to be a kid, what it is to be a little girl, what it is to grow into becoming a young woman. Mm-hmm. How was that experience for you by virtue of being of a different faith, in this case, Islam? Mm-hmm.
Honestly, no different than any other American kid growing up here in the United States. I grew up in a very similar environment that Sumbul grew up in, where my father... there are two girls and one boy. My father had expectations, not of marriage, not of having a number of kids, my mother and father, but going to college and be having a 4.0 GPA and either go into medicine or engineering. Otherwise, you're a loser if you didn't do either one. So both my siblings are physicians. My dad is a physician. They're both married to physicians. I studied engineering as the rebel in the family because I was really smart in math. I studied engineering for 2 years before I went into liberal arts because my mother wanted us to get Egyptianized by going back to Egypt. And that's how I got my degree from American University. But no, I grew up as a, you know, having the same, my dad had the same expectations that he did of my brother and my sister as well. And my father was a strong Arab male. I mean, he you know, culturally Arab, and maybe he was more secular, but he grew up in a very, you know, sort of religious Arab household and had those values. And he treated me and my sister equal to my brother and expected careers out of us, not marriage and not, you know, and not kids. And I think that you'll find that to be quite typical of American Muslims.
Sumbul, you grew up where?
In Southern California, in Los Angeles. So so I grew up in a place, a particular place and time when there were no other Muslims around me. I was the only Muslim that any of my friends had ever come across. I was the only Muslim that any of my teachers had ever come across. So I was... Any Star Trek fans? Yeah. So you know this idea of first contact? You know, when you first contact an alien species? Well, that was me. I was the alien species. So so I answered a lot of questions about Islam, and usually it didn't come up. You know, only when I maybe went to a birthday party and they had pepperoni pizza and I couldn't eat it because it was pork, and then I had to explain why I didn't eat pork. As I got a little bit older, it began to matter more. In high school, I started fasting for Ramadan, so it's no food or water until sunset for 30 days. And for those of you who might not know, it's so that we understand what it's like to not be able to get food or clean drinking water. It's so that we improve our, you know, connection to God, and it's to encourage discipline. So it's only for healthy adults. So when I was in high school, I started to fast, and I came to school one day only to find that was the day that we were running the mile for the presidential physical fitness test. So I had a choice, you know, like, do I tell my curmudgeon of a PE coach who's never heard of Muslims? And, you know, do I go up to him and say, it's against my religion to run? Yeah, right. Or do I just suck it up and run? And of course, I sucked it up and ran. And, you know, when I talk to students about this, they always know that I sucked it up and ran. And one kid I remember raised his hand and he said, what was your time? So, and then, you know, I didn't. So it became more of an issue. And then when I went to Stanford, it was, you know, I was living in the dorm and everybody knew what everybody else was doing. And all of a sudden I was saying, okay, how am I going to pray 5 times a day with my roommate not noticing since she lives a foot away from me? You know, how am I going to figure out if there's pork in the dorm food when nobody knows what's in the dorm food? So... It was an Interfaith 101 experience.
All right. Unfortunately, on that unappetizing note, we have to call it an evening. I do want to say to all of you who are here, I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and my office. I hope as well that you feel you learned a lot. I certainly do. Would you please join me once again in thanking our two panelists, Sumbul Ali Karamali and Maha El-Junaidi. Thank you. A thank you to all of you who took the time to be with us tonight, as well as those who are listening or watching on the radio and the web. And in keeping with the Commonwealth Club tradition, we are adjourned. Thank you all once again.